Professor Geraldo Cadava, we thank you for being with us, Professor of History and Latino Studies at Northwestern University in Chicago. We'll link to your piece in the New Yorker magazine, Florida's Right Turn on Immigration. And thank you to Andrea Reyes, an immigration attorney, speaking to us from Jacksonville, Florida. And that does it for our show. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warrenoff. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
And this is radio station WUSB in Stony Brook, where the time is just about 6 o'clock. Time once again for another edition of Off the Wall. And a very good evening to everybody. The program is... What's the name of the program?
Off the Wall.
Oh, that's right. Off the Wall. I do so many programs. Off the Wall. It's Tuesday night. And this is WUSB. And I am Oh, gosh. Who am I this one? Emmanuel. This is Emmanuel, and that over there is Kyle.
Indeed. Kyle, I'm right here.
Yes, yeah. And here we are for another action-packed edition of social commentary and current events and things like that.
Various commentary, varied, often inspired by letters that people write to OTW at 2600.com.
Not nearly enough letters.
We would like writers. We like when people correspond.
Mm-hmm. Yes. OTW at 2600.com. If you need help figuring out how to send email, well, we can't really help you with that, but that's our email address. And we'd like to hear from our listeners. Okay, so we're going to keep it local this week. We're going to talk about local things, things that we did in the area, but also how things from the world are affecting us locally. And I think that'll make a nice sort of smorgasbord of things. We had a journey this weekend. We went on a hike. We went on a 7-mile hike. Boy, that was something. Let me give you a little background first. We headed out east to Greenport, which is basically probably the biggest town east of Riverhead on the North Fork, and hung out there for a little while, got coffee, and then took the ferry over to Shelter Island, went on we went to a nature preserve that's on Shelter Island. If you've ever been to Shelter Island, this is an incredible place to go to.
It feels like the whole place is a nature preserve.
It really does. It's its own community. It's an island in an island. I mean, it's you know, how do you even describe that? We're on Long Island, and part of Long Island is another island called Shelter Island. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's sort of attached. It's a part of Long Island.
It's not attached, because it wouldn't be an island if it's attached.
Okay, yeah.
That's why you need the ferry. You need the ferry to get there.
I think that's what you're trying to get the clarification on. And that's... there's probably a term, but it's inside of a cove. It's surrounded sort of by...
Yeah, so islands work. They have coves, they have little bays and things like that, but it's an island. It's an island within an island. So that's the best way I can describe it. But, you know, speaking of the ferries, I have... there's two ferries. Okay, I got a bone to pick here. There's two ferries. If you go, you know, from Greenport to Shelter Island, you're on the north part of Shelter Island. Basically, Shelter Island is between the two forks of Long Island. And if you're not from Long Island, look it up on a map. We don't have time to explain it. The North Fork, the South Fork, and in between the two forks is an island called Shelter Island. And you get to Shelter Island from Greenport by taking what's known as the North Ferry. And to get to the Southern Port, to get from the Southern Port, that connects with Sag Harbor on the South Fork. And you take the South Ferry for that. So... it's interesting because they have this deal where, you know, you can get a round-trip ticket for you know, a discounted price. But not if you take the other ferry. Now, you'd think the North Ferry Company and the South Ferry Company would somehow be related. They have the exact same policies. They only take cash. They have the same rules, same regulations, almost the same fare. They're off by $1. But they claim not to be at all related to each other. There's one ferry company on the south part, there's one ferry company on the north part. One's called the North Ferry, one's called the South Ferry, and they have nothing to do with each other.
Which do you like better?
Does anybody believe that's true? I'd like to know. Especially you people out in Shelter Island, is that true? They really have no... I mean, the tickets do look different. I'm looking at the North Ferry ticket right now. That's the one that's a dollar less. And it's rather nondescript. It just says car and driver, one passenger. There's a little
QR,
little QR thing down there.
Machine readable bits.
I don't know what we're supposed to do with that. It says stop engine, said brake, no smoking. And then the South Ferry. I don't know what this means. If it's service you want use, what does that mean? That's what it says on the ticket. You have any idea, Kyle, what that means?
They might say you want us, but they added
yeah, are you telling me there's a typo on every single one of their tickets?
Oof.
If it's service you want use. That's what it says.
Oh, wait. It's got a serial, a number below it. Maybe it's indicating that if you need some kind of customer service,
what kind of customer service would? Okay, so hold on. If it's service, you want use and then a number.
Yeah,
that's like, a bizarre way of saying.
Well, it's a serialized number in like a different color and stuff.
Yeah, but it doesn't tell you how to get service after that. Okay, well, anyway, the point is that's just one of the oddities of, you know, Shelter Island is so much more than just the ferry companies, but just kind of it's kind of a weird way to be introduced to it. So we went to this preserve called the Mashemak.
Both services were affected.
And what?
both of them were affected.
We're done with the ferries.
All right,
we've
I
moved
just
on.
Wanted to
we've
point
moved
out.
On, Kyle.
We were able to, you know, get
you
from
know,
one side to the other.
There should be a word for that when you move on and then somebody drags you back into the previous topic. There should be a word for that. Is there a word for that? Someone look into that. It's very annoying. Mashemak is what we're talking about now. Mashemak is the name of the nature preserve that is run by the Nature Conservancy. That's where we took our 7 mile. We figured it out how far we actually went, because we got on the red trail, and then we transferred to the green trail, we just did the calculations there. And what do you think of that? What do you think of that hike through the forest, through the fields?
Well, without any pretext, I didn't have any kind of expectations. I didn't really know what was what the layout was or how substantial the trails were, what kind of options, and then of course what the terrain was once we got there. It was fun though. I enjoyed, and once we were able to kind of gauge it on the initial parts of the trail and get familiar with it, it just felt a little bit nice. I mean, the weather was good. It was a little overcast and
well,
rainy.
Well, no, actually, the weather was terrible. It was Saturday, and
that
it
depends
was,
on what you call it.
Was, well, I mean, yeah, I'm a hypocrite here because I like rainy weather, so saying terrible is wrong. But it was raining. It was pouring rain, and we had to decide, do we want to do this? Because what we wanted to do was do sort of like a loop where you go out east, explore Shelter Island, hang out in Sag Harbor a little bit, and then head back west. So that kind of a loop, and it involved walking around outside, but it was pouring rain when we left. But luckily, when we got to the nature preserve, the rain kind of let up. And
it was shifting, yeah, it was warmer.
Yeah, we walked for, 3 hours, maybe more, and then the rain started again. We were on the ferry heading to Sag Harbor, and it was pouring rain. So that was good. That felt great. And just being able, you know, if you can walk for a couple of hours, it really feels good to do it. I mean, you know, you're achy the next day or so, but it really is good for you, and it's something that we need to do more of, I think.
Well, and getting away from a lot of traffic and other areas, and putting some of that preserved environment between you and just clearing your head and so forth. It was very relaxing and just so interesting. Great job they've done just preserving and keeping that area pristine to educate people and contribute to the habitats that rely on it.
And these places they're in our backyard. They're right there, you know. You know, we talk about it. We extol the virtues of nature, of having all this wildlife at our fingertips, basically. But do we take advantage of it enough? That's the thing that we really need to do more of. And they're everywhere. They're everywhere, these little enclaves. But Shelter Island is an amazing place. I think our signal gets out there. I'm not sure. Any Shelter Island listeners, let us know. Not quite the season yet. I think maybe after Memorial Day, maybe after July 4th, that's when it really starts to get packed with tourists and basically people like that. But definitely worth going. I'd like to go in the winter, actually. I think that would be a really good time to be there.
Well, and you only get a certain, like, little glimpse of it, especially if you take on some of the longer parts of what they've got marked. But I could see going back and just spending a little bit more time or doing a shorter one if you're introducing people to the area or you're unfamiliar with that part, such a remote part of the island.
I just want to explore more of the islands around here. I want to go to Gardner's Island, even though I don't think anybody's allowed to go there unless your last name is Gardner. I'd like to go to Plum Island, although you might get an animal disease if you do go there because that's what they used to, you know, focus on. And, of course, you know, Fisher's Island, Robin's Island. There's a lot of them. There's a lot of islands around here, and they're all worth exploring. But, you know, people are getting out. People are exercising. And it's an important thing to do, but it's also ridiculously dangerous. Now, we heard about this on the way out there. You know, they have these new trails. They call it the Rail Trail. Basically, it goes from the Port Jefferson area all the way out to Shoreham, and it uses the old train right-of-way because there used to be a train that went out that way. And that's why it's called the Rail Trail, and basically you can ride your bike, you can walk, take your dog, whatever. And we heard about this this case on Friday where this this 20-year-old kid was hit by a truck on the bike trail. And the reason it's dangerous, even if you're on the bike trail, is because it crosses streets. But here's the thing. I'm reading this story from the Times Beacon Record, Village Beacon Record, rather. Suffolk County Police 7th Squad detectives are investigating a motor vehicle crash that seriously injured a bicyclist in Sound Beach on May 19th. The bicyclist was riding a bicycle eastbound on the North Shore Rail Trail when he stopped at the intersection of Halleck Landing Road at a stop sign. He then proceeded through the intersection where he was struck by a pickup truck. Now, he stopped. He did everything right. He, you know, looked both ways, I would imagine, and crossed the street. And this pickup truck just wailed down the street and hit him. Anyway, so clearly, you know, it's great to have a bike trail, but clearly it's not enough. You need to have some kind of signaling system where people crossing have right of way, or there's some kind of a traffic signal of one sort or another. There was just simply no excuse not to have this. If stopping at a stop sign and crossing the street isn't enough to be safe, well, I can't imagine what else you could possibly do. You know, it sounds like this guy did everything he was supposed to do. And it's possible the person driving the truck, who stayed, by the way, also was doing the best they could. Maybe it was a blind. You've noticed this, Carl. You say that it's kind of hard to see.
Yeah, as a driver, someone I've you know crossed a couple of these. Someone who's observed it in crossing over. I've noticed that at least a few of the ones that I've crossed over, and there are many along this rail trail that are on very busy roads and roads that have a pretty steady pace, I would say between 30 and 40 miles an hour on some of them. And I think it's a study of it is really due because the trail is good. Mm-hmm. The roads themselves aren't necessarily flawed. However, some of them, and the ones that I've noticed in particular, are extremely narrow and overgrown, especially this time of year. There are no, as you said, indicators flashing, anything automated that detects it. Mm-hmm. And the roads themselves leading up to it perhaps do not have enough markings to encourage drivers to slow down and to observe. But basically, if you took the speed limit and increased it by 5 miles an hour or so, and
increased it?
Yeah, for a study, and like measured the stopping distance.
Okay.
And took a photograph of like where that vehicle would be if it had to stop going a certain rate of speed. There's no time to notice someone. There, you can't see very much on some of them leading up to where the actual crossing begins.
Uh-huh.
And if they enter, there's no time to see it.
So,
you can't see around it. You can't see the trail.
It's hazard just, then. It's a hazard the way it currently is set up.
Yeah, it's incredibly tight. There's really no time. And you take a car going 40 miles an hour,
which they do,
that doesn't slow down, and they aren't. They need the encouragement. They need to have more of a visibility. I don't know if it's the vegetation itself, if that's causing the problem, or the overall design, because I've noticed some of them are on very narrow arterials, or coming off the arterial to connect a lot of the roads. And I just don't know that the functional considerations have been made, and there have to be some augmentations.
Okay, you know, this is a simple problem to solve. Yeah, it involves spending, and it involves cars slowing down a little bit. We're going to have to deal with that because, you know, people are precious, and we want to make sure they stick around. So either, you know, we have something like a mandatory stop at all these crossings, which I don't think is the answer, because that's just a lot of extra fuel and frustration and more traffic. Or you have maybe a speed bump right before every single crossing, which, you know, sometimes that works.
I think speed bump or speed zone.
Speed zones are, I mean, yeah, that's great if people obey them. But I think really the answer is a technological answer, where basically it's either a sensor that senses somebody about to cross and flashes lights. That's what they do in the Setauka Greenbelt Trail. Or something a step beyond that. I mean, we can try that and see if people obey it or you know, are cautious. I doubt it, seeing as how people drive in really bad fashion these days. Something involving a signal, where basically somebody approaches, it's like a train crossing. It's a train, you know, a train right away. So if it were a train going through there, yeah, you would get the red light and cars would have to stop. Now, people aren't constantly crossing this trail, you know, every couple of minutes maybe. So yeah, somebody has to stop, car has to stop, so somebody can cross safely. Who is going to object to that? Seriously, who is going to object to something basic like that? We obviously need to have the system.
Yeah, the solutions are many. I think there can be some kind of customized way to look at it, but I think they need to be full on like zebra crosswalks with a signal you can press by hand, or something that detects someone like 10 yards within like a 10 yard box on each side. And because even then, if it's like right at the posts, the bollards where the street starts, and it senses someone there, if they are careless in some way, if they don't dismount, because the Setauka Trail you mentioned, there's plenty of visibility on both sides. There's automated flashing. Still very scary if you're going at the speed limit, and considering a cyclist to be in full control. What if it's a family going on a ride and a younger rider who goes out in front carelessly and doesn't, you know, all of a sudden you've got a very tragic situation.
Of course.
So those kinds of things, even with the protections, they are full on pedestrian crossings, and in other parts of the country, most dedicated bike trails, if they're crossing the streets, I feel like they have a button and a zebra, like a full crosswalk. And drivers need to understand that's their responsibility too. Like, there are bike trails that are a part of the roadway, and I've noticed there is some increased marking just in the last couple of weeks on the roadways that are a part of established bike routes. But those riders on the trail are also they're also pedestrians. They are in traffic.
Right.
They are vehicles. They have every bit as much of a right to use the roadway.
New York State law requires you to stop for anyone in a zebra crossing. I think a lot of people don't know that. I can attest to that by crossing in zebra crossings, having cars whiz by. This is something. It's almost a worldwide thing where if you step into a zebra crossing. And by zebra crossing, in case you don't know, it's basically the large white stripes on the asphalt. You step into that, cars have to stop until you cross. And I think something like that, perhaps with flashing lights, would help in this particular situation. Hopefully that cyclist recovers, but boy, you know, you think a bike trail is where a cyclist will be safe. And not on Long Island, so we need to improve this. Anyway, we heard about that as we were heading out east, and it was a bit sobering. There was another fatal crash on Sound Avenue, which is a two-lane road that heads east on the North Fork. And that caused all kinds of traffic mayhem, but, you know, that pales in comparison to the horror it caused to the person, person's family. I do advise people to explore the wilderness, drive carefully when you do, and cherish the things that we have around us, because it's a great time of year, and there is so much around us. So, yeah, you know, we wound up in Sag Harbor. It was raining pretty hard, actually, by the time we got to Sag Harbor. That is a cool place. That is a very cool town. We just grabbed a bite there, but we wound up in some kind of a bar. This guy just came up to us and said, "Hey, take this newspaper. I printed this newspaper." And apparently he did. This is a newspaper I'd never heard of before called the Waldo Tribune, volume 35, issue 2, which means this has been coming out for 35 years now. This is a full-fledged newspaper, and it says the children's newspaper that's read by parents and grandparents, too. The 33rd year. I'm not sure how it said 33rd year if it's volume 35, but I won't get into that. It doesn't even cost anything, and it's filled with all kinds of stories for kids. Most of them in this issue are all about the Big Duck, which, in case you don't know, the Big Duck is this building out east where it's like a gift shop, and it's the pride of the whole East End. But how cool is it that there's this newspaper that this guy, you know, in Sag Harbor is printing, and everybody knows about it, and it's distributed to schools all over the place.
That's right. The duck was built in the 30s, and it is a staple. And, of course, there's all kinds of articles, duck-themed, students building models of the duck because it's a landmark on Long Island. And even the places that we visited, they were advertising in here. I noticed the place, that corner place, was there. And there's just so many... local businesses and stories in here, and this is a bit of, I don't know, community that you have in all parts of the country, and you got to appreciate it when you're around people getting the word out and thinking of something so specific. And of course, I'm also thinking of the duck farms and potato farms and the deep history of agriculture on Long Island.
Well, you know, it's interesting. We stepped into this place to grab a bite, and I guess we were immediately noticed as strangers, people that weren't from there. So that's why he came to us and said, here are a couple of copies of my newspaper.
If you're around, yeah, you know when somebody's from out of town.
So that's great. That's we really got the experience. Okay, moving on though to more serious issues. I got a letter today from our local representative. You know, our congressman who replaced Lee Zeldin, Congressman LaLotta, sent out a weekly newspaper. You know, there's good and there's bad in this. I'm going to read a little bit. There's a section called The Terrible Liar. Yeah, last week I voted to refer the case of Representative George Santos's expulsion to the House Committee on Ethics. While I would have preferred there to be enough votes to expel the sociopath's scam artist, Congressman Desposito has spearheaded the next best option to refer this matter to the Ethics Committee, where we expect a result within 60 days, and for the terrible liar to be gone by resignation or expulsion before August recess. Well, you know, I got to say, hearing this from a Republican is a good thing. I would prefer him, obviously, to be gone now. I think it's hypocritical for them to bounce this to a committee and to not deal with the situation right now. And I sense the same kind of frustration from Congressman LaLotta, which is a good thing. And I'm sure if he was in charge of this, maybe he'd be out right now. Okay, but you know what? It didn't last, because then the next section of this newsletter is, "Don't NYC my Suffolk." Don't NYC my Suffolk. You know, Suffolk County is where we are, of course. NYC, we know what that is. I joined leaders from across Suffolk County to clearly and unequivocally state that Long Islanders should not have to bear the weight of the crisis at the border created by the combination of the Biden administration's failed border policies and the sanctuary city policies of New York City. Yeah, you left out something, Congressman. You left out the fact that they're being bussed up here by Republican governors. That's why they're coming to New York. It's not because Mayor Adams is bringing them here. It's basically they're being sent here. All right, so let's at least acknowledge that fact. And you can extend that and say, yes, because of the broken border, sure. But let's focus on the actual cause of what you consider to be a crisis right now. Continuing, Mayor Adams and New York City officials chose to have sanctuary city policies. It's called values. It's called, you know, American values. But we won't get into that. We don't have enough time. Predictably, their city resources have become overrun, and veterans, homeless, mentally impaired, and victims of substance abuse now have access to less or no resources because of the city's sanctuary policies, which have attracted so many who have crossed our border illegally or on unviable asylum claims. Okay, a few things here. First of all, I'm surprised to hear a Republican care about the homeless, the mentally impaired, and victims of substance abuse, because usually those programs are being cut by your colleagues. So it's refreshing that you actually seem to care enough to say you want to fund those programs and not cut them and keep those people taken care of. Yeah, that would be great, because I've sure seen a lot of problems over the years caused by budget cuts and social programs being cut. So it's nice to see a Republican congressman who apparently values those things. But to claim that it's migrants somehow and refugees who are taking away these resources, that is misleading at best. And we will try to get into this. But let's continue with the letter here. Now, New York City, not Suffolk, should have to pay for the consequences of those policies. Well, here's the thing. They are paying for it. Yeah, they are paying for their housing. And they're just looking for physical space. And we'll get into that in a second. We are a compassionate nation, are we? Because I'm not getting that. I'm not getting that from a lot of what I've been reading over the past week. We are a compassionate nation, one with rules and laws that no one is above. And here's the other thing. You claimed earlier that they crossed the border illegally. That's not true. That's not true. Everyone has the right to claim asylum. That is a human right, and they are following the law. Look, they are here. Their names are known. They're on a list. They're on a bus. They're being housed in various places. It's not like people are just running across the border willy-nilly, and we have no idea, you know, who they are, what they want, where they're from. All these people are on a list. They all are waiting for their court dates. They're following the rules. They're abiding by the rules. And to make it seem like they're lawbreakers is really, really unfair and a great disservice. And to say that, you know, somehow they're pitted against the veterans and the homeless, that's, again, misleading at best. Okay, we'll get into the immigration issue in just a moment, but there's another issue in this newsletter that Representative Valletta sent out called Restoring SALT. New York State has the dubious distinction of having the highest combined property sales and income taxes, and while many New Yorkers are fleeing to low-tax states like Florida, the rest of us continue to plead with our representatives in Albany to provide us tax relief. Okay, interesting. I am doing my part to make Long Island more affordable by seeing to it that New Yorkers get more of their SALT deduction back. The cap on the SALT deduction has caused significant hardship for Long Islanders, and in a time of such economic uncertainty, working families need support. SALT is state and local tax. Now, it's interesting, and you know, I applaud these efforts to get rid of the cap, which currently is $10,000. Valletta wants to bring that to $60,000 for single filers, $120,000 for joint filers. But what he fails to mention, and this has to be nothing but an oversight, is that the reason why there's a $10,000 cap on the SALT deduction is because of the tax bill from 2017 that Donald Trump passed. Remember that? That's the one where, you know, millionaires and billionaires benefited and the rest of us didn't. And here's an example of how the rest of us didn't. This is why many of our overall taxes went up in 2017 and beyond, because the richest among us benefited, you know? And to say that you want to restore the SALT deduction, at least tell the whole story. Don't make it seem like it's Albany's fault. No, this was a federal thing. This was part of the 2017 tax reform. So, you know, I guess you're not allowed to say anything negative about Trump or about that era, but it's not hard to figure this out and see that you're being very misleading. So, you know, I want to be supportive. I want to say this guy's got, you know, the right idea, but when you mischaracterize what immigration is all about, when you leave out vital details concerning why people are paying more in taxes, you have to wonder just how honest is somebody. So that's where that stands. And also, you know, everyone's freaking out over the ceiling, you know, the debt ceiling that we're about to hit June 1st. Keep this in mind, okay? The entire reason why we are having these issues right now can be traced back to that 2017 tax package, which added, over $1 trillion? And basically, you know, imagine that you have a credit card and you max it out. You spend all this money and then you decide that you're not going to pay any more than a certain amount. You're not going to pay your debts. You're not going to pay what you've already spent. We've already spent this. This has already been allocated. So now, basically, we're facing this debt ceiling because we no longer want to pay for the money that was wasted on the rich.
And they want to tank generations of people's ability to generate wealth and earn with the national credit rating and everything. It would completely upend and take a long time to recover from, as far as the dynamics in the market, and people will pay the price for that, working ever harder to you know, keep what they've made.
Absolutely. All right, well, anyway, that's the newsletter we got today. A lot's going on here in the area, and a lot of it is not good. Out in Riverhead, wow. They have a town supervisor out there who I was not aware of, but boy, she is a nightmare. Yvette Aguiar. Basically, she has declared war on New York City migrants, what she's referring to as New York City migrants. Basically, putting forth an executive order declaring a preemptive state of emergency, get this, to block motels and other facilities from accepting migrants. and you know, this is, motels are interested in housing migrants. These are motels that are empty or have vacancies, and they're willing to talk with the mayor of New York City and be paid to house migrants. And Riverhead Town Supervisor Yvette Aguiar is saying, no, I'm going to forbid you from doing that because migrants are a problem. Yeah, migrants are a problem. This is sickness. This is the kind of ugliness we see in other parts of the country, and it's happening here as well. Constitutional law professors say it's extremely difficult for states and localities to regulate immigration issues in a way that does not conflict with federal laws. According to Pete Spiro, a professor at Temple University who specializes in immigration and constitutional law, these measures are at least constitutionally problematic. They interfere with the right to travel, a right that extends to non-citizens. Again, non-citizens in the country legally. but not citizens. Looking for citizenship, you know, fleeing all kinds of oppression and horrors that we could not even imagine, but here, completely legally. Continuing, these counties are looking to offload any burden presented by these non-citizens onto other localities. It's a cornerstone of our constitutional system that states and localities can't erect obstacles to internal freedom of movement. Now, a dozen counties throughout New York State, including Rockland and Orange, have declared states of emergency to prevent Mayor Adams from sending them migrants. They cite a state law allowing county executives to establish states of emergency in the event of a disaster, rioting, catastrophe, or similar public emergency. What is similar here? Where is the emergency? A bunch of frightened families trying to find a place to live? Trying to find a better life for themselves? That is what has you in this kind of a panic? Rockland and Orange counties were granted temporary restraining orders last week that blocked Mayor Adams from sending them asylum seekers, while the New York City New York Civil Liberties Union responded with a federal civil rights lawsuit contending the orders violate the Constitution by restricting the rights of the migrants to travel and reside across the state. New York State has for a long time recognized the right to intrastate travels for people to move freely or reside in any place that they would like to. That's according to the NYCLU. These orders very clearly on their face restrict that right, and they also have the right to do that free of discrimination under the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. Ilya Soman is a professor at George Mason University who teaches constitutional law, federalism, migration rights, said the orders could also violate federal housing and discrimination laws that bar discrimination based on national origin. Tiffany Graham teaches constitutional law at Touro Law School, and she said it's unclear that municipalities have a sufficiently strong legal justification for blocking the migrants, particularly as New York City has pledged to pay for their housing. So this is just purely fear and hatred of a particular type of person. And it's happening all around us now. You don't have to go to Tennessee for this. No, it's right here. And, you know, while that idiot who runs Nassau County has already pledged to block migrants from going to Nassau County, good luck. Good luck with that. That hasn't happened in Suffolk because our county executive is a little bit more sane. But our legislature is not. Our legislature is now mostly Republican. And they are trying to block asylum-seeking migrants from being sent to Suffolk County. Well, today they received a rebuke from immigration advocates who spoke at a press conference at the William Rogers Legislature Building in Hauppauge, ahead of the Suffolk County Legislature's regularly scheduled meeting where the issue was expected to receive attention. So that could be going on right now. Our nation is best when we serve as a beacon of hope for people seeking freedom, safety, and protection from persecution. That, according to Elmer Flores, a representative of Long Island Immigration Clinic, which assists those seeking asylum, we know this because immigrants have been integral to New York's growth and successful in building our bridges, to giving us the entire dynamic, to revitalizing our upstate communities, and so much more. The group objected to Republican legislators' announcement on Sunday that they would vote soon on hiring a lawyer to explore what can be done to block migrants from being placed in Suffolk. Presiding Officer Kevin McCaffrey said the lawyer would pursue any and all legal options available to protect the unfunded location of any asylum seekers in Suffolk County. Well, Kevin, catch up, all right? It's funded. It's being paid for. New York City Mayor Eric Adams' administration has been running out of room for the hundreds of migrants that are being sent there from Texas, Florida, other places, and is looking to every county in the state for help. And boy, you know, it's embarrassing when you see your fellow citizens act so selfishly and filled with hatred and fear and ignorance. As of Mid-May, the administration has not yet asked Suffolk or Nassau counties for assistance. Hasn't even asked yet, and already our leaders are freaking out over this. Now, Governor Kathy Hochul said last week she is considering using state properties, including State University of New York and City University of New York campuses, to temporarily house asylum seekers this summer, and Stony Brook University, where we broadcast from, is very possibly one of them. And boy, that would be great. I would welcome people there. If we have the room, if we have unused dormitories over the summer to house migrant families, to house asylum seekers, to house refugees, to house people who are trying to find the American dream, what better thing for a university to be used for? My God. It's sickening to see people reacting in this way when, in all likelihood, your ancestors did the exact same thing many years ago, or maybe only a few years ago. And, you know, here's a little bit of information, too, from Texas, where a lot of the hatred comes from. This is from a study in 2017 from Angelou Economics of Austin. Estimated the number of unauthorized immigrants in the state had increased by 250,000 to 1.65 million. They racked up $1.7 billion in K-12 and higher education costs, $99.8 million in health care costs, and $224.7 million in incarceration costs. But that $2 billion was exceeded by the $2.7 billion in tax revenues and lottery ticket sales that flowed to the state in 2017 from unauthorized immigrants. Yeah. These are the unauthorized immigrants, too. These aren't people who are following all the rules. This is the unauthorized. So, yeah, they are paying more than what they are costing, is the conclusion. So you can't believe anything that is coming from these Republican leaders. They're not losing. They're gaining. The only thing they're trying to do right now is create a climate of fear and misinformation and hatred and suspicion.
Yeah, and by not accommodating and providing resources, you're setting up conditions, you know, stripping people of rights like those seeking asylum, and not being prepared, not allowing crises like this to be managed. You're setting up conditions and then further disrespecting human rights, making it that much worse for people that are here, to not even mention the sociocultural impacts, the behaviors and attitudes, discrimination and so forth towards people that are on this particular journey. So, yeah, it's pretty rich considering also the history of Long Island. In the 60s and 70s, there were labor camps and, you know, a lot of people who have been here for generations. And, you know, people think that because they don't have representation or visibility, that they don't contribute or exist as a neighbor. And people that are really truly serving the county. Mm-hmm. So in the crises like this, why wouldn't you want to increase support for people that might speak the same language? They show up, there could be beds waiting and people that can speak to them that, mm-hmm. that have maybe relatives who've gone through that experience. But by strangling that opportunity to receive people, you're just creating a much more hostile environment, much closer to like the slavery conditions that, you know, relegating people in labor camps did in back in the day. And mm-hmm. it's really hurtful and backwards when you could do so much more for people in a as diverse a place as New York State.
Absolutely, and the United States in general. And you know, when you talk to people who are opposed to this sort of thing, and you hear their concerns, it's not like we don't sympathize. We don't get those concerns. But the fact of the matter is, most of the things that you are concerned about aren't accurate. You're being fed misinformation. You're being fed something to get you to panic, and it's working like a charm. But if you just do a little bit of digging, we did a little bit of digging. The Carnegie Corporation of New York, you might have heard of them, well-respected, they funded a study by Alex Neureste of the Cato Institute. The Cato Institute is kind of conservative, I believe, libertarian. They're basically not liberal, let's put it that way. They have a bunch of myths that they'd like to dispel involving immigration. And let's just go over a couple of them. Immigrants will take American jobs, lower wages, and especially hurt the poor. No, immigrants don't take American jobs, lower wages, or push the poor out of the labor market. That has been established. That does not happen. Myth number two, it is easy to immigrate here legally. Why don't illegal immigrants just get in line? The fact is, it's very difficult to immigrate legally to the United States. Immigration law is second only to the income tax code in legal complexity. Myth number three, immigrants abuse the welfare state. Fact, immigrants use significantly less welfare than native-born Americans. Myth number four, immigrants increase the budget deficit and government debt. Fact, immigrants in the United States have about a net zero effect on government budgets. They pay about as much in taxes as they consume in benefits. Myth number five, immigrants increase economic inequality. Fact, maybe. The evidence on how immigration affects economic inequality in the United States is mixed. Some research finds relatively small effects. Some finds substantial ones. The standard of living is much more important than is the income distribution. Myth number six, today's immigrants don't assimilate as immigrants from previous eras did. Fact, immigrants to the United States, including Mexicans, are assimilating as well or better than immigrant groups from Europe over 100 years ago. Think about that. Myth number seven, immigrants are a major source of crime. Fact, immigrants, including illegal immigrants, are less likely to be incarcerated in prisons, convicted of crimes, or arrested than native-born Americans. And again, I'm reading this from the Cato Institute, who uses phrases like illegal immigrants and things like that I would not use. I would not consider them in any way liberal, leftist, or sympathetic towards causes that I agree with. And that tells me that what I'm reading right now is about as accurate as you can get. Let's just go over. There's a lot of myths. We don't have time for all of them. Okay, here's another one. The United States has the most open immigration policy in the world. Fact, the annual inflow of immigrants to the United States as a percentage of our population is below that of most other rich countries in the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. Amnesty or a failure to enforce our immigration laws will destroy the rule of law in the United States. Here's a fact. America's current immigration laws violate every principal component of the rule of law. Enforcing laws that are inherently capricious and that are contrary to our traditions is inconsistent with a stable rule of law. Some hard words there. All right, here's another one. Immigrants bring with them bad cultures, ideas, or other factors that will undermine and destroy our economic and political institutions. The resultant weakening in economic growth means that immigrants will destroy more wealth than they will create over the long run. Fact, there is no evidence that immigrants weaken or undermine American economic, political, or cultural institutions. Period. So, yeah, that's a report from the Cato Institute. And I'm sure there are others as well. What you're told about immigration, about the threats, what you face as a result of people searching for asylum in our country, what you're being told is not true. You're being told that for a reason. And the reason is to get you to react. to get you to act out of fear. And it's what governments have done since governments existed, is manipulate their populations. Whether it's a county legislature, a county executive, a governor, even the president. You have to look into the facts. And you have to look into yourself as a human being. And it's just, it's shameful to see this. To see it happening right here. In the next few weeks, this is going to increase. We're going to see more people coming to New York. What's odd is everybody was saying how when Title 42, is that, did I have it right?
Yes.
When that ended, the COVID-19 restriction, that we were going to be deluged with all kinds of people crossing the border, and actually it went way down because everybody's following the rules. So, yeah, we panicked and then found out that we were panicking for nothing. But then we decided we're going to continue panicking and come up with all kinds of crazy rules, laws, restrictions, and fears. Immigration is something we should be welcoming. It's what has built this nation. It's what will continue to build this nation. Right now, there is what I consider to be a rather silly rule that people who are waiting to find out if they are accepted for asylum can't get a job. It's not that they don't want to work. It's a restriction. I think that should be changed because we certainly need people to work in all kinds of places for a decent wage to help them, to help us. And all these new people coming here could be exactly what we need.
Yeah, certainly. There's huge hiring efforts being made in all kinds of parts of the economy. And there's been, you know, really unfair labor practices, too. Stories about miners being put to work in really harsh conditions lately. A lot of good reporting on that lately. So it needs to be a fair and a safe system, something that, you know, respects human rights.
We're out of time, unfortunately. We will be back next week. Stay tuned for Finn. Remember to be compassionate and don't believe everything you're told. Question everything. We will see you next week. OTW at 2600.com.
And stay tuned to WSB Stony Brook.